From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right now, a grand jury is investigating a Catholic bishop in Springfield, Massachusetts, for criminal charges, including the sexual abuse of two boys. Last month, U.S. bishops released details of two studies that show that since 1950, nearly 11,000 people say they've been sexually molested by a priest, and that at least 4,000 Roman Catholic priests had molested children. Investigative journalist Jason Berry first waded into the sexual scandal in the Catholic Church in 1984 when he put the spotlight on a pedophile priest in Louisiana. Back then, Berry was a lone voice in the wilderness, railing against sexual corruption in the Catholic Church, his church. 14 years later, Berry is still fighting, he's still angry, and now he's naming names. In his provocative new book, Vows of Silence, co-authored with Gerald Renner, Jason Berry lays no small part of the blame squarely on the papacy of John Paul II. The crisis, writes Berry, grew from a history of sexual secrecy demanded by the papacy. Tonight on Point, Jason Berry on the bottom line in the Catholic Church's priest sex abuse scandal, a line that leads to the Vatican. What do you finally take away from the scandal and all that it has revealed? How far, how deep in the church does final responsibility lie? And what is the final responsibility of Pope John Paul, if any? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Jason Berry, investigative journalist and co-author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. Good evening and welcome, Jason Berry.
My pleasure to be here.
Jason Berry, you write in your book that the ultimate paradox of this pope is tremendous, is awesome, to use your word. You say the pope who championed freedom from political dictatorships turned a cold shoulder to human rights within the church. You've been at this for a long time. How do you draw the line from the sexual abuse that we've all learned so much about in the last few years to Pope John Paul?
Well, in 1993, he was abundantly briefed by bishops from the United States, Australia, Ireland, and Canada on their ad limina visits. These are visits that each bishop makes every 5 years. A substantial amount of information about those bishops, interestingly, from Catholic News Service in Rome. Many of these men spoke to him about the pedophilia cases and the problems that they were having as bishops. And even farther back, as we learned, my co-author Jerry Renner and I, and report in this book, In 1989, the American bishops sent a group of canon lawyers to Rome in hopes of negotiating the right within the Code of Canon Law to defrock or laicize pedophiles, a right that was only allowed under canon law by Pope John Paul. Under canon law, the pope can intervene in any case at any time. It's not like a democratic judicial system.
Yeah.
The Vatican refused to give the American bishops that right to kick out known child molesters, ironically enough, on the logic that the American bishops were, at least in Rome's eyes, being seen as too permissive in granting too many marriage annulments to divorced Catholics.
What did that have to do with it?
That's exactly what I asked the priest in Rome when I interviewed him in that section of the book. And he insisted that it was a question of canon law. If you're not following the law on marriage annulments, therefore we will not give you the right under canon law to kick out pedophiles. And I think that sort of detachment from Rome is what marked the scandal from the very beginning. And Pope John Paul, God bless him, one of the greatest popes certainly in the history of the church, nevertheless did not squarely face the information that was abundantly presented to him in the late 1890s and well into 1993.
So you point there at detachment, and detachment from a problem like this clearly is not a good thing. But you also point in the book very strongly to the culture of secrecy, and you draw that back to this pope as well. Why? How?
Well, I think you have to look at John Paul again in a historical sense. This is a man who, for most of his life prior to becoming pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church, had lived in a dictatorship in Poland. He was, in effect, the head of the opposition party, the Catholic Church. And John Paul's ideal, his model of the Catholic priest, is one who is celibate, obedient, upstanding, someone who follows the regulations. I think he has almost a romanticized idea of celibacy as a form of chivalry. his notion was it worked in Poland. Eventually, the communist empire crumbled, and let us give due credit to the Pope for the role he played in that.
Enormous role.
Yeah, Gorbachev himself said that without the Pope, the empire probably would not have fallen. That said, nevertheless, he was unable to look inside the church at the internal contradictions and convulsions within clerical life itself, and was simply unable to confront the reality of a sexual underground in the priesthood.
How close to the Vatican, how close to the Pope were participants in what you've just called the sexual underground in the priesthood?
Oh, quite close. There was a Polish archbishop who, as a priest, was a member of the papal household. He left and was rewarded with an archbishop's position in Poland. Later, I learned in Rome that it was widely known that this guy was coming on to people, even people who would sometimes enter the Vatican trying to see the Pope. He was obviously a man with sexual problems, and yet when he finally went down, as all these men do, claiming that it was a misunderstanding, that he didn't really do it and so forth, and they finally removed him. In 1995, I think the most glaring case, which got only fleeting news coverage in the United States, happened in Vienna. Cardinal Gror of Austria was accused by a number of men who had been under his tutelage in a monastery of having sexually molested them. And the Vatican's response was to let Gror retire and take over a religious shrine near Vienna without admitting that he did anything. The result of that was 500,000 Catholics in Austria and Germany forming a group called We Are the Church, which in a very real sense prefigured the forming of Voice of the Faithful here in the United States. So it was this obsession with secrecy and being unable to admit what men had done even after the news media were covering it.
The word that you attach to the culture and the secrecy is corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual corruption, or even without the modifier, just corruption. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think if you take the idea of the Gospel of St. John, seek the truth shall make you free, the notion of secrecy to protect people who are violating the laws of the church has to be considered a form of corruption. When children are raped and people are sexually violated, and men who do that are recycled to new positions, that is a form of corruption that in this country many of the grand juries, criminal grand juries, have been looking into. And I think what many of the prosecutors, not just in New England, Tom, but in other parts of the country are asking right now is, how did they get away with it? Why were priests allowed to have this freedom, and why were bishops able to move them around for so long? That, to me, is an example of corruption.
And what is your answer to the why? Yes, there was corruption. Why? I mean, not all... I mean, secrecy does tend to breed problems, but secrecy alone doesn't necessarily breed problems of this depth on this scale.
That's absolutely correct. It's a very good question, and I hope I have a good answer for it. I think what many of us who are Catholic have struggled with through this dark night of the Church's soul, if you will, is that the presumption of celibacy, that men on the altar renounce sexual intimacy and occupy a higher plane, spiritually, so to speak, for it, is one, it's a sort of mystique that is crumbling. And it has been very difficult for many Catholics, I think, to come to terms with how widespread sexual behavior patterns are within the clergy. So when truth itself cannot be confronted, when bishops counterattack victims or chastise the news media or seek to threaten them, as happened to me when I was working on my previous book on this topic, Lead Us Not Into Temptation, mm-hmm. you have to ask yourself, why are they afraid of the truth? I mean, if the gospel tells us to seek the truth and the bishops are hiding behind this wall of institutionalized mendacity, mm-hmm. then I think it's not just the news media that it's concerned, but people in the pews.
And you're saying they were afraid of the truth because the truth came into conflict with the policy of celibacy? Is that what you're suggesting or not?
No, not quite. I'm saying that they were afraid of the truth because it collided with their own base of power. Celibacy is the cornerstone of clerical governing. This is a system built on sexual segregation. Men who do not marry and do not have children control the church, and anyone else who tries to get a seat at the table, if you will, has to do a lot of waiting. What the church desperately needs is a separation of powers, an independent mechanism so that if a bishop is found to be lying, concealing, moving people around, then he is removed. That's certainly the central conclusion of this book.
You describe a kind of, I mean, this is probably the wrong phrase, but a kind of sexual mafia within the church. You're nodding your head, yes, so I'm not too far off there. How would you characterize the, was there a group, was it, is there, was there an active, deliberate, conscious, self-identifying group of priests who were engaged in this abuse? Was it more casual? How do you describe the base of people involved in this widespread problem?
Well, you've asked several questions. Let me see if I can take them one by one. First of all, I would not say sexual mafia is a bit strong. There have certainly been instances well documented of several priests sharing victims. This has happened in different parts of the country. I wouldn't suggest that this is the dominant way these pedophiles and child molesters have worked, but there are examples of that, yes.
But was it known between parishes and communities and cities and countries that this went on and it was tolerated? And, you know, was there a kind of wink and nod society within the Society of Catholic Priests?
Well, I think there was a wink and nod mentality whereby men like this were sent around from one parish to another, often across dioceses, often out of, you know, to different countries. That's been abundantly well documented, yes.
You write about a couple of men who represent two very, very different vectors within the Catholic Church on this problem. First, Tom Doyle, a priest who tried to confront it. Tell us that story.
Tom Doyle is a fascinating guy. He grew up in a very conservative home, entered the seminary in the early 1960s, became a Dominican priest. This is a guy who probably would have gone into the FBI, I think, had he not become a priest. He came out of that very traditional Irish Catholic conservative sensibility. In 1985, he was named canon lawyer. Excuse me, 1981, he was named canon lawyer at the Vatican Embassy in Washington. And he served for the better part of 5 years the papal nuncio, the Vatican ambassador, Archbishop Pio Laghi, who has since gone to Rome and is a cardinal. Doyle co-authored a pioneering report in the mid-1980s, 1985, warning the American bishops in almost 92 pages that if they did not develop a policy to remove these men who were abusing children, they faced an enormous crisis. Certainly a prophetic document when seen with the monopoly of hindsight. He lost his job, was edged out because they didn't want to hear the truth. This is a classic case of a good man speaking truth to power within the structure of his own church. He then joined the Air Force as a chaplain, remains in the Air Force today as a priest, and has probably done more damage to the Catholic bishops of this country than any single individual by testifying in hundreds of lawsuits, criminal prosecutions, and to grand juries on behalf of victims.
He still wears the collar.
He doesn't wear the collar a lot, but he's certainly a priest.
And when you say damage, damage to reputations, legal damage, but you are clearly a big supporter of this man.
Oh, I think he's a hero. And I must say, like many people of a most postmodern bent, I don't have a great deal of heroes. There are certainly people I admire. But no, I think he's a heroic figure who, if Tom Doyle had kept his mouth shut, he would be a cardinal today. But his conscience would not let him do that. And so he stands, I think, as a as an example to many of the priests, certainly Father Scahill in Springfield, who stood up against Bishop Dupre and and has been a heroic and catalytic figure in the Springfield diocese. There are others like Tom in Father Ken Lash in Mendham, New Jersey, who has worked for years to re-knit a parish that was torn apart by a terrible pedophile in that little town. Tom went much further than these men because he had such power and had internal documents and was invaluable to the legal system.
And he picked them up and he made the issue of it in the parish after parish, city after city. There's a lot more absolutely fascinating detail here. We're talking tonight with Jason Berry. He's co-author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. You can join our conversation tonight. What is your final takeaway from this scandal and all that it has revealed? How high, how deep in the church does final responsibility lie? And what is the ultimate responsibility of Pope John Paul? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the bottom line in the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal, the line that leads to the Vatican. My guest tonight is Jason Berry. He is co-author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. He's been an investigative journalist on this story for a long, long time. You can join the conversation tonight. Did a pope who championed political freedom turn a cold shoulder to human rights within the Church? Has the scandal changed your relationship with the Catholic Church, and how? Has the Church fully confessed its own sins as we sit here tonight? Is the rot gone? Has the Catholic Church reached redemption? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jason Berry, you just told us a story of a quite heroic priest, by your own estimation, who went to battle over this, and maybe missed a chance to be a cardinal as a result. He's now an Air Force chaplain, but he's brought justice and helped bring justice in many, many cases. There's another story that you tell here of a very, very different color, one that I was not familiar with, one with roots in Mexico, but that go right up to the Vatican. Share that with us.
Father Marcial Maciel, despite the French surname, is a Mexican priest who in 1941 founded a religious order called the Legion of Christ. Father Maciel is 84 today, and I might add a very hale 84, living in Rome, hiding from the news media. He has been accused by 9 men, 7 Mexicans and 2 Spaniards, one of whom is now deceased, in a canon law case filed in the Vatican in 1998 after a good deal of media publicity prior to that, beginning actually with news reporting in the Hartford Courant that my co-author and colleague Gerald Renner wrote about in the early 90s. Basically, what we found in the reporting that we did was that Father Maciel had a long history of accusations, which this pope ignored, utterly ignored. The first letter that went to the pope with many specific accusations of sexual abuse by Father Maciel was from a priest who has since left the priesthood, Juan Vaca, in 1976, in 1978, and again in 1989, as Vaca was leaving the priesthood to marry. The language of those letters, which we quote in the beginning of the book, is a riveting cri de coeur, even with all of the legal documents that we've seen in this country. And yet, time and again, each time these men from Mexico and Spain tried to get the Vatican to listen to their accusations and under the Church's own canonical laws to remove Maciel, they ran up against a brick wall. And so you have the irony, and I would say this is frankly a cameo of the crisis in America, where a priest who is sheltered and rewarded in Rome with 9 men, former seminarians, accusing him, stands in such a jagged contrast to the situation in the United States. Were Maciel a priest in America, he would be out. They'd throw him out under the bishop's charter of 2002.
Now, Father Maciel, story of these 9 men, that's a large number, but at this point we have heard stories of many priests committing many offenses. Why do you point to his as being such an egregious example? Why does his indict the Vatican? Why would the letter get to the Pope? We don't have the sense that in many of these cases the letters, the communication, the cri de coeur was floating so high.
Very good question. This man is the head of an international religious order. He founded a group called the Legion of Christ, which has 500 priests, they say, spread across a number of countries.
Including the United States.
Including the United States. Their seminary is in Orange, Connecticut. Their headquarters is in Orange, Connecticut. The seminary is in Cheshire. This is a man who has been praised by the Pope. And so the correct line of authority went from the priest making the accusation to the Vatican Embassy in Washington.
And we should say this priest was among the 9 who had been abused.
Was among the 9.
For a dozen years by this.
Exactly.
By this,
in fact, the first accusations against Maciel were by 2 priests, one a Spaniard, one a Mexican, both following the letter of canon law with the late bishop of Rockville Center, Long Island, Frank McGann, sending a dossier of these accusations To the Vatican through the diplomatic pouch via the Vatican Embassy in Washington.
And with Father Vacca saying, I was taken into this man's bed when I was 12 or 13 years old and kept in a kind of sexual slavery for a dozen years. This is not a light charge.
Well, he didn't say sexual slavery.
No, but he said he was dominated in mind and body by this man for a dozen years.
Yes, it was certainly a tyrannical psychosexual relationship. And the Vatican did absolutely nothing.
Why?
Because I think they are used to hiding sexual secrets. That's the core theme of the book. This is a power structure that is riddled, honeycombed with sexual secrecy. A wise Jesuit of my acquaintance once said political secrecy and sexual secrecy go hand in hand. And certainly in the Catholic Church, that has been the reality of these sad years in which this crisis has become an international reality. Let me just add one other thing, Tom, if I may. Mm. All of the cases that have, if you will, exploded into the media imagination have come from the English-speaking countries with a base in English common law, the United States, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and Ireland, where the seminaries are barren because of the many scandals there. In contrast, Italy has a different legal system without the sweeping discovery powers that an attorney, say, like Eric McLeish here in Boston or Jeffrey Anderson in Minneapolis or Steve Rubino in New Jersey. These are men who have unearthed huge volumes of documentation that have gotten into the media discourse and into the public discourse of this country. We were only able to find, Jerry Renner, my co-author and I, 19 cases involving priests in all of Italy. And that is because the legal system does not have the same sweeping discovery powers. The news media did not treat it in the same way that it has in these countries. And as a consequence, the Vatican took the view that, well, this is an American problem. If we can hide our own secrets in the Vatican, let the Americans wash their dirty hands and figure out a way to do it without bothering us. They never thought the scandal would get to them.
You quote, and I forget who it is, but someone saying it's worth tolerating this abuse so as not to disabuse millions of other Roman Catholics of their faith.
One of the most jarring statements in the book is by a woman named Martha Vigan, who is an Austrian canon lawyer who resides in Vatican City and serves people who bring canon law cases before the Vatican. She was the canonist who represented these nine men. There was an eminent, esteemed canon lawyer from Mexico City, Antonio Rocani, Father Rocani, who prepared many of the documents, but he in effect did not, if you will, have the kind of license to do it in Cardinal Ratzinger's canonical court, and she did it. And her statement after they stuffed, aborted the case, was that, well, maybe it's better for eight of you to suffer so that many people don't lose their faith. That's not my idea of faith.
Does that still stand as a worldview in the Vatican today after everything that's happened, at least in the United States?
Well, as the lawyers say, that calls for an opinion, but my opinion would be yes, it does. I think the problem is that the Pope, God bless him, has never focused on this issue in the way that he should have. Now, one could argue and debate that because of his Parkinson's, he's not fully in control. But
he was very much in control and a very healthy and robust man during many of the years when this was going on.
He absolutely was, and I think the most important thing he could do to, if you will, begin to at least eliminate part of this dark mark on his legacy as pontiff would be to meet with some of these survivors from different countries. I think it would be a very important move, not just symbolically, but because other bishops would then follow suit.
We're talking tonight about the bottom line in the Catholic Church's sexual abuse scandal, the line that leads to the Vatican. My guest is Jason Berry, author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Pat is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Evening.
I just really wanted to say that I very much support the opinion that the book is stating that the priests who have violated the trust and the faith of the other Catholics should be treated as criminals because it is a criminal act. I personally am a victim, as it's so called. But this was years ago, and the priest has since passed away. But it was looked upon as something you just didn't talk about.
Pat, when Jason Berry draws a line from victimization, abuse like yours, to the Vatican, and even to Pope John Paul, do you follow that line? Do you buy that?
I do. I do agree in some aspects. The responsibility does lie, I believe, with the Pope and his staff to simply develop some type of disciplinary action other than hiding the fact that this happened or trying to cover it over.
And, Pat, when you see everything that's happened in the United States in the last year or two, do you now feel confident that this problem is being addressed in the U.S. and globally?
No, I don't. I personally feel that, again, it's a simple matter of transferring the offender to a different parish, to a different locale, and perhaps to a different stature in the church. It doesn't seem like it's being addressed as a criminal act, which it is.
Pat, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate you being with us tonight. Jason Berry, how do you look out now upon the landscape after all the headlines and all the scandal? Has the airing been complete, at least in the United States? Are we on the other side of this problem now or not?
Well, I hesitate to sound like Jeremiah with the horn, but I'm afraid that there are a great many landmines still out there that will probably blow up and make stories in the months to come.
So still undiscovered cases or ongoing abuse?
Well, I don't know about ongoing abuse. I think the bishops are trying to remove known pedophiles. There are other cases, however, where the Survivors Network is accusing certain bishops of harboring men who should be removed. I think what's more important is the bishops who have not been removed. McCormick in New Hampshire entered into the equivalent of a plea bargain. They ought to get rid of him. He shouldn't be the bishop.
Bishops who themselves were involved in abuse or who shielded abusers?
Well, who shielded abusers and who have a measure of responsibility that has now caused prosecutors to either investigate them or force them into a relationship where the local prosecutor has a measure of control over the Catholic Church. McCormick is one, Palarchik in Cincinnati. That archdiocese paid a $10,000 fine. I think if these men err to that degree, then they should be removed. Robert Lynch, the Bishop of St. Petersburg, his diocese paid $100,000 to his former press spokesman because of a sexual harassment claim against the bishop. If you pay the money, then I think you should go. Frank Rodimer was the bishop until very recently of Paterson, New Jersey, paid $250,000 from diocesan funds because he shared a summer house with a priest who, over a period of many years, brought a boy to his room right down the hall from where the bishop slept, abused the boy. The priest is now in prison. Rodimer retired with a nice dinner.
What does it mean that these men have not been tossed out?
What it means is that the Vatican does not have control over those bishops who should be removed. They are unwilling to be judicial and remove men who have made horrendous mistakes.
You're saying they don't have control. They don't have the power to toss them, or willing to?
The latter. They certainly have the power, but they're unwilling to. Now, one could speculate on whether the Pope is well enough to do it. I think the problem is that he doesn't see that men who are who are symbols of this cancer in the church should be removed. His attitude is once a priest, always a priest, once a bishop, always a bishop. Interesting note here, Tom. Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles met with the review board led by Robert Bennett that just produced this report some months ago. He had seven attorneys in his office and two PR spokesmen meet with this reform board that was there on a fact-finding mission. Roger Mahoney today...
That's not exactly the posture of an open book.
I think that's a charitable understatement. Roger Mahoney today is fighting a criminal grand jury investigation of all of the personnel files of accused priests. He doesn't want them to go. He's going to spend a fortune on legal fees to try to prevent the grand jury from getting them because he saw what happened to Cardinal Law here. Once the Shanley documents got out, the 52 priests said, we don't want this man as cardinal, and Law resigned.
So there's still a resistance. There's still
Absolutely.
That lack of candor. Rupert is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Rupert. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's the first time I'm listening to the show, and I love the show, but this time I'm a little upset. Let's not forget that for the benefit of the discussion, that I am Catholic, and I was in the seminary for 4 years.
Okay.
So I lived that life, and I know well how it works inside. Let's not forget that the Catholic Church is an institution that preaches forgiveness, and ultimately the responsibility I see solely rests with the priest. These men know absolutely what's expected of them before they go in, way ahead of the time that before they go in. I was 18 years old when I went in, and I knew exactly what was expected of me. So.
But, Rupert, when individual priests fail to live up to expectations, doesn't the church have some institutional responsibility?
Yeah, I believe it does. However, to take it all the way up to the Pope and to say that he's somewhat responsible, I don't see how he could control that.
So it's all about the priest and just the priest. It's all the priest's fault if this happens.
The priest and directly his superior, because he must have a superior. If the superior is the bishop, then it's up to the bishop.
There's a couple things there, Rupert, that we'll pick up, and I thank you for your call. Jason Berry, first of all, Rupert says men know what they're getting into when they come in to the seminary, and secondly, it all rests on their shoulders.
Well, theoretically they should, but it's obvious that because of the dramatic decline in the number of men who have gone into the priesthood, in the last 50 years, more men have left the priesthood than entered. There is a sort of erosion of the traditional standards, the expectations of clerical life. This is something the Bennett Report focused on. And while I think the gentleman who called is certainly correct in saying that one should know when one goes in, the responsibility here we're talking about is that of the hierarchy, of the power structure. And in my view, the problem is the power structure because they have not abided by their own rules under the Code of Canon Law.
But you also bring it right back to celibacy. You say it is hard to imagine a rejuvenated priesthood without optional celibacy. We'll talk about that. But then you quote Richard Sipe saying you can kick out ephebophiles. You'll have to define that for us. But the system is constantly producing others to fill their shoes by favoring those who are emotionally immature and reject women.
Yes. An ephebophile is it's sort of a $10 word, but it means a person who is drawn to sexually fixated on older adolescent children as opposed to a pedophile who advances on younger prepubescent children. In a way, it's a bit of an academic distinction. But what Sipe, who is certainly a learned figure and author in the literature on this topic, is driving at is the fact that so many seminaries have attracted young men who are psychosexually immature, and go in with some kind of fear or resistance to women, and they end up forming attachments, same-sex attachments, and by the time they become priests, they often abuse teenage boys.
So in the context of modern cultures where sexuality is pretty much out there, mm-hmm. he's suggesting that you can't have a celibate priesthood and a healthy priesthood.
Yeah, he is. And frankly, I agree with him. I'm not saying that there aren't healthy celibate priests, but we are living in a changing age. And in order to rejuvenate the Catholic Church, I think if the celibacy law were made optional, those men who are able to sustain a celibate lifestyle will continue to go in, perhaps in religious orders, perhaps in the diocesan clergy. But I think we would see a flood of qualified people going into the priesthood if they had the right to get married.
We're talking tonight with investigative journalist Jason Berry. He has followed the sex scandal abuse in the Catholic Church for a long, long time. His new book is Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of Pope John Paul II. You can join this conversation. Is the problem above the pay grade of the U.S. bishops, finally? Is it in the Vatican? Is it still in the Vatican? And is celibacy finally the problem? Would married priests fix it? Are you in the pew or are you gone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the bottom line in the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal, the line that leads to the Vatican. My guest is Jason Berry. He's co-author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I'm very pleased to be asked to participate in this dialogue, and I applaud everything you're doing as an author and also the NPR. I remember two years ago, the Hartford Current, I was living in Connecticut at the time, wrote an extraordinary editorial which pretty much said that the individuals who were being molested were those who generally were in needy situations, very often young boys, and I was one of them, single-parent families who had a deep religious belief. And there's no question in my mind that it goes as high as the Pope. I've written to every bishop. I've written to every prince of the church. I've only received a three-page press release from Roger Mahoney of all individuals.
You wrote them about sexual abuse that you suffered, and what you got back was one press release?
One press release from Roger Mahoney. Nothing from law, two letters to the Pope, one letter to the Franciscans, one letter to the Maronall Fathers.
And, Michael, you say you think it was in part because you were a working-class kid, not a privileged kid.
Oh, no question at the time. No question. I think that the church was taking advantage of people in positions of, it was a power play. And that's what that kind of sex is. It's power play. It's just like rape. It's power, it's violence, it's control. And I'm always amazed at the number of people who say, why does this happen in the church? Well, because it was allowed to happen, and that's what attracted people of that ilk to join the church. And and every priest who has not reported this situation, and I submit to you that every priest in this world has known about this. And I think that the only honest statement was made by the interim administrator in Springfield, who was taken to task for it, is we didn't think there was anything wrong with it, the Monsignor.
Yeah. Michael, we appreciate your perspective, and we hear you loud and clear. Thank you for your call. Jason Berry, what about this last piece from Michael? I assure you, he says every priest knew about this. True?
I think a great many did. My heart goes out to Michael. He's absolutely correct that so many of the kids who were abused came from families who had a need for a surrogate father figure, a second father figure, an avuncular figure sometimes. But I think we have to remember that even within the priesthood, the layers of secrecy are such that in not every instance did every man know what others were doing. Certainly in a rectory situation, that would hold true. I guess what troubles me the most is that the American bishops, scandal-battered though they are, have now got this document. It's not nearly as strong as it should be, the Bennett Report, but at least they are now on record with this report, and I would like to see them hold the Vatican responsible for its own failures.
Do they have that power?
They have the power to speak publicly. The Pope is not going to take out a bishop for suggesting that Father Maciel be removed. And I think Father Maciel is a stain upon the legacy of this Pope.
So you're waiting for U.S. bishops to stand up on that front. You also write about an issue you say that cannot be easily reported without offending just about everyone. You call it the gay clergy issue. What does that mean?
Well, it's been widely reported. There's been a huge surge in the number of gay men into the priesthood over the last generation. And obviously, some of these men are very fine priests. But it's also quite clear that quite a number of gay priests, and I'm not talking about men who molest children, but there's a sort of materialistic, narcissistic strand of within the priesthood of gay men who have a greater allegiance to an agenda of being gay than to being a priest. And as a liberal on most issues, I find that very troubling. I interviewed 50 gay priests for my previous book, and I found that once you gave these guys assurances of anonymity, the first thing they did was start talking about their sex lives. My response finally was, look, if you want to be sexually active, why not leave the priesthood? If you're going to be a priest, shouldn't you lead the celibate life that we assume those on the altar abide by?
But it's what a complex issue for the Catholic Church. It's now a very vigorously opposing gay marriage. On the other hand, it's got these problems within its ranks that you describe right there, and you take it all back to the Pope. You write very movingly about Pope John Paul. You say no Pope in centuries has been so visionary as to insist that the Church should become more fully conscious of the sinfulness of her children. He's been way up front on that, talking about sins and errors in the Church around Galileo, the Jews, the Muslims, Luther, the Indians, the Inquisition, the Crusades, religious war, Rwanda. But on this, you say he had a kind of tragic naivete, the kind of hubris we associate with kings in a Shakespearean drama.
Indeed, yes. I think he romanticizes celibacy as a form of chivalry. And while that vision certainly, I think, has been at the center of his life as a priest and helps explain the the fortitude that he manifested in leading the church in Poland, and certainly in his assistance to Solidarity, the union movement in Poland during the waning years of the communist empire. Nonetheless, he has failed to look within the culture of the priesthood itself and perform the necessary reforms that the church so desperately needs.
You essentially conclude it's going to require the next pope to do that.
Oh, I think there is a reformation building in the Catholic Church, whether you want to call it a revolution or a reformation. We are living in a long unfolding narrative. I would hope the next pope does something, but the alternative will be a gradual siphoning off of people from the Catholic Church, at least in this country, going to other denominations. And that is what I think would be most unfortunate for people to leave the church. I'd rather stay in it and fight for the good.
Jason Bury, you've been fighting for a long time. As you sit here tonight, we just have a few seconds left. Where does your meter read? Are you more on the optimistic side or not?
Well, besides St. Paul, my other hero is Camus. And like Sisyphus, we push the stone. I hope to find a plateau where it won't roll down on me, but I won't make any predictions as to when I'll find that plateau.
Keep pushing, my friend. Thank you much for all of your work and for this book. Jason Bury is co-author of the new book, Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. Terrific to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for
being
here.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a St. Patrick's Day story about growing up poor in 20th century Dublin. This is On Point. Across the country and the sea, Irish and non-Irish alike have donned the green today to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. In New York, 150,000 marchers braved snow and freezing temperatures in the largest St. Patrick's parade in the country. In Washington, President Bush accepted the traditional bowl of shamrocks from Ireland's Prime Minister Bertie Ahern and announced plans to visit the Emerald Isle in June. And in Dublin, pubgoers enjoyed their last St. Paddy's Day before a new smoking ban is implemented in 2 weeks. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, we bring you a reading from Irish author Bill Cullen's autobiography, It's a Long Way from Penny Apples. The memoir traces Cullen's journey from growing up in the slums of Dublin to becoming one of the wealthiest men in Ireland. In this excerpt, a young Cullen, known then as Liam, witnesses the strength of his mother, Mary, who fearlessly rescues a neighbor who is being evicted from her tenement.
Mary Darcy opened her eyes and sat up listening. "Did I hear eviction?" she asked slowly. Rita nodded, just as the roar went up again. "Eviction! Eviction! It's the corporal from Mrs. Walsh!" With that, there was a loud bang of a door hitting the wall and the tramp of hobnailed boots in the stone hall. Mary's face flushed red and she stood up with anger in her eyes. "Give me that poker, Rita," she said. "And Liam, you get that sweeping brush and come with me. You girls mind the little ones." There was a pause as she retied her white apron around her swollen tummy and then took the poker and waved for Liam to follow her. "I don't believe this," she said. "It can't be an eviction in this day and age in this kip of a house." She opened the door and then leaned back to dip her fingers in the holy water font and blessed herself and sprinkled some water on her son. There were roars and screams coming up to the stairs from Mrs. Welch's room at the back of the hall. "Let's go," she said, and down the stairs she went with Liam behind her. When they turned the corner of the stairs, there were three corporal lads in the hall, with Mrs. Welch's table and chairs already been handed out from man to man. Some children were standing barefoot, crying, and she could hear Mrs. Welch's voice from the room pleading tearfully, "No, no, don't throw us out in the rain." Mary let out a roar. "What's going on here, you bowsy?" she said, and smashed the poker on the banisters with a loud crash that brought the men to a halt. "Who's in charge here?" she shouted. And out from the room came a big red-faced man, followed by Mr. Sutton, the rent collector. "I'm in charge here, missus," said the man, in a country accent. "Now you just buzz off and mind your business. This is an official corporation evictment, and you'll be in the clink if you're not careful." Mary gave the banister another bang with the poker. "Well, aren't you the big, brave culchy now, threatening women and children, sneaking in here when our men are out working to pay your rent? If it's trouble you want, you've come to the right place, and I'm telling you to leave Mrs. Walsh's things there, or you'll have me to deal with," she shouted. "And as for you, Mr. Sutton, you come out from hiding behind that culchy and speak up for yourself. Don't you know Mr. Walsh was in hospital for a few months with the kidney stones? and he's back working now, and he'll clear off the arrears. Don't you know all that? And why are you here with these lachicos doing your dirty work? Mr. Sutton just blinked behind his glasses as the big man did the answering. Listen, woman, it's none of your business. He's had plenty of warnings. When any tenant falls behind by more than 6 months' rent, it's out. That's the policy, and there's no discussion. Turning to his men, he said, right, me lads, let's get on with the job. But before they could move, Mary smashed the banister again with the poker. So that's the policy, is it now? Let's throw the sick man and his family out on the street is the policy, because they owe the corpo a few lousy pounds. Let's get a big, brave culchy with his pals to dump them out in the road. Sure, they're well used to this job. Didn't some of you help the English landlords during the famine days? Turncoats and informers you are, who take on only the women and children. We leave the room there empty and put Mrs. Walsh out in the rain. Well, that's the policy we had when the Brits were here, and many's the brave Irishman's blood was spilt to get them out and change that policy. Is this what Michael Collins fought for? Of course, he was a great man from Cork, and he was shot in the back by one of his own, the like of you. Let me tell you this, me bio. The first man that moves a stick of furniture out of this hall will get my poker over his head. Mary came down the stairs into the hall and took a chair from one of the men without resistance. Now, Mr. Sutton, why don't you get these fellas out of here and see how we can clear off Mrs. Walsh's arrears? Sure, I've £2 here in me pocket. Wouldn't that be a better thing to do than have some of these culches in hospital? The big man was livid with temper at the insults that had been heaped on him. He would have killed any man who used those words to him, but he was helpless and frustrated when faced with a pregnant woman. The rent collector broke the tension. Well, are you saying, Mrs. Cullen, that we can have the arrears paid, he asked. Of course I'm saying the arrears will be paid, Mr. Sutton. Just get rid of these bios, and we'll sit down on these chairs, and we'll work everything out between ourselves. All right then, said Mr. Sutton, turning to the big man. You go on back to the office, Seamus, and I'll sort this out. The big man kicked the wall in frustration. Be Jesus, I'll go back to no office, he said. We'll go down to Conway's pub, and you'll meet us there to pay us for this day's work, so you will. And out the hall he went, with the sparks flying from his hobnail boots. The other men put down the furniture and trailed out after him. Bring that stuff in now, Liam, said the ma, and why don't you put the teapot on, Mrs. Walsh? I'm sure Mr. Sutton could do with a cup of tea while we talk business. 20 minutes later, Mr. Sutton left, with the promise of 6 shillings a week payment off the arrears, as well as the rent from next week on, and the ma still had our £2 in our pocket. When Mary arrived back upstairs, it was to a steaming mug of tea and a slice of toast ready for on the table. She smiled and sat down. Isn't it a great bunch I have here now, she said. The girls looking after the house, and this young fella with his sweeping brush standing in for his da. You can put the poker and the brush away now, son, all is well. But as she sipped her tea, she grimaced and said, Liam, I think you better run down and tell Mother Darcy to come up here quick. And Vera, will you put that big pot of water on the stove? That evening, my sister Carmel was born in the tenement room. The children had all been hooshed down to stay in Mother Darcy's. And when we trooped back for bed, the ma was sitting up with the new baby, and me dad, Billy Cullen, was there beside her. Mother Darcy was having a mug of shell cocoa, with a proud look on her face, and her sleeves still rolled up. Me sister Rita told us the real story. Mother Darcy brought the new baby up from the chapel in her shopping bag.
Author Bill Cullen reading from his autobiography, It's a Long Way from Penny Apples. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.